Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Inglés.
C1.
Comprensión oral. Tarea 1. Escuche la grabación. Elija la mejor opción. A, B o C. El texto se escuchará 3 veces. Ahora dispone usted de 2 minutos para leer las preguntas.
Michael Prophet, welcome.
Thank you.
Incredibly, you are the first new chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary in 20 years.
That's true.
You've been there, though, way longer, before, you know, all of our businesses started with computers. Mm. Are you surprised that this tome of written words has survived?
Well, I think that my predecessor, John Simpson, and his colleague, Edmund Viner, were very quick to pick up on the potential of the OD in an electronic context. And they converted the OED into digital form in the late 1980s. And by the time we published the second edition then, it was already available on CD-ROM. It was one of the first reference works available on CD-ROM. And then it was also one of the first reference works online in 2000. So it was, we saw an opportunity to publish in a different way, and I think we grabbed it with both hands.
So you have more than kept up with the times.
I hope so, and I think we have to think now about how we can change the dictionary so that it brings it to a new audience who often, I think, expect their content to be in situ, you know, when they need it, where they need it, rather than having to go to a separate reference work.
So what is your mission? How will you do that?
I think it's the challenge is to continue to satisfy the current readership, which is quite broad, and also to bring in a new generation of users who have to perhaps expect it to be more dynamic content that merges with their own needs day to day, I think.
You know, a lot of people will say, hang on a second, you know, and maybe I'm reflecting the sort of traditional generation, that people like to see this great, big, weighty book that they know they can flip through and find the words and peruse them. Do you sometimes feel you're being forced into this new, brave new world, or is it absolutely vital?
Well, one of the interesting things about the OED is every form in which it's been published until now is still surviving. It's still in print, it's still in CD-ROM form, which surprises a lot of people, and it's online. The advantage of going online is that we can update it much faster. It was quite slow to compile print volumes. They're very complex. They often involve complex typography and different
languages.
How long
do they take, by the way? I heard it takes, I mean, decades.
Yeah,
we think
that we'll finish this current new edition, which is a revision of the whole 20-volume dictionary, within the next 20 years. So it's a long-term project. The original dictionary took 50 years.
50
More,
years?
I mean, it was conceived, actually, from conception to publication, it was about 70.
And how many words for 50 years?
Well, there were about 400,000. We're now up to about 800,000, which is a lot. If you consider that the average person's vocabulary is roughly between 25,000 and 40,000. You can see why they need a dictionary, because even people who are doing 40,000 at the highest end, it's about 5% of what we've got in the OED, and that's not all the words in the language.
Okay, so this started ages and ages ago, and we're going to use our modern mappy here to bring up some of the words for love, for instance.
Yeah.
Now, love, apparently, if I touch this, will show a huge history of different spellings throughout the ages.
These are all the early spellings. Spelling in English fixed around the 18th century, so in terms of the English language, it's relatively recent. All these spellings date from before then, and most of them didn't survive later than that. But if you want to know the way Shakespeare spelled love, for example, you need to know about these.
Do you know which one it was?
More than one.
More than one.
That's the thing, because there wasn't fixed spelling. And one of the things that this is a good example of what we might do in terms of realizing the potential of the OED as data, if you like, rather than just in the dictionary, is if you're using a search engine, it's very literal-minded. So, in theory, you need to know all those spellings to retrieve all the examples in Shakespeare. So put them into a search engine and have them working behind the scenes, as it were, to allow you to just put in the current spelling and retrieve all the relevant examples from that period.
And then there are new words, as we've been saying. We had this year the selfie that was heard around the world. Obviously, President Obama with the Prime Minister of Denmark and, indeed, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. This... Everybody's made a huge big deal about it, the fact that it is in the Oxford English Dictionary. Should it really be there?
Well, it's not actually Oxford English Dictionary yet. It's in our current dictionary, which is called the Oxford Dictionary, so slightly confusing.
Well, tell us. What does that mean?
Online, we have Oxford Dictionaries online. Well, that's a current dictionary, so it's really for practical, look-up of contemporary words. They tend to have short definitions. OED is about giving you the whole history. We looked at some of those variant spellings, the early spellings. Telling you about the biography of a word, if you like. So you see the whole life story, and a lot of our most common words go back centuries and centuries, right back to Old English.
OMG, for instance. Where did that first turn up?
Well, first turned up, and this will surprise most people, in a letter that an admiral wrote to Winston Churchill in 1917. So it's not quite the youth speak that is decried, is it?
It is amazing to think that. All right. Thank you very much indeed, and congratulations on being OED's new chief editor, the first in 20 years. Michael Prophet, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Michael Prophet, welcome.
Thank you.
Incredibly, you are the first new chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary in 20 years.
That's true.
You've been there, though, way longer, before, all of our businesses started with computers. Mm. Are you surprised that this tome of written words has survived?
Well, I think that my predecessor, John Simpson, and his colleague, Edmund Viner, were very quick to pick up on the potential of the OED in an electronic context. And they converted the OED into digital form in the late 1980s. And by the time we published the second edition then, it was already available on CD-ROM. It was one of the first reference works available on CD-ROM. And then it was also one of the first reference works online in 2000. So we saw an opportunity to publish in a different way, and I think we grabbed it with both hands.
So you have more than kept up with the times.
I hope so, and I think we have to think now about how we can change the dictionary so that it brings it to a new audience who often, I think, expect their content to be in situ, when they need it, where they need it, rather than having to go to a separate reference work.
So what is your mission? How will you do that?
I think it's the challenge is to continue to satisfy the current readership, which is quite broad, and also to bring in a new generation of users who have to perhaps expect it to be more dynamic content that merges with their own needs day to day, I think.
You know, a lot of people will say, hang on a second, you know, and maybe I'm reflecting the sort of traditional generation. Mm. The people like to see this great, big, weighty book yeah. that they know they can flip through and find the words and peruse them. Do you sometimes feel you're being forced into this new, brave new world, or is it absolutely vital?
Well, one of the interesting things about the OED is every form in which it's been published until now is still surviving. It's still in print, it's still in CD-ROM form, which surprises a lot of people, and it's online. The advantage of going online is that we can update it much faster. It was quite slow to compile print volumes. They're very complex. They often involve complex typography and different
languages.
How long
do they take, by the way? I heard it takes, I mean, decades.
Yeah,
we think
that we'll finish this current new edition, which is a revision of the whole 20-volume dictionary, within the next 20 years. So it's a long-term project. The original dictionary took 50 years.
50
More,
years?
I mean, it was conceived, actually, from conception to publication, it was about 70.
And how many words for 50 years?
Well, there were about 400,000. We're now up to about 800,000, which is a lot. If you consider that the average person's vocabulary is roughly between 25,000 and 40,000, you can see why they need a dictionary, because even people who are doing 40,000 at the highest end, it's about 5% of what we've got in the OED, and that's not all the words in the language.
Okay, so this started ages and ages ago, and we're going to use our modern Mappy here to bring up some of the words for love, for instance.
Yeah.
Now, love, apparently, if I touch this, will show a huge history of different spellings throughout the ages.
These are all the early spellings. Spelling in English fixed around the 18th century, so it's, in terms of the English language, it's relatively recent. All these spellings date from before then, and most of them didn't survive later than that. But if you want to know the way Shakespeare spelled love, for example, you need to know about these.
Do you know which one it was?
More than one. That's the thing, because there wasn't fixed spelling. And one of the things that we... This is a good example of what we might do in terms of using, realizing the potential of the OED as data, if you like, rather than just in the dictionary, is if you're using a search engine, it's very literal-minded. So, in theory, you'd need to know all those spellings to retrieve all the examples in Shakespeare. So put them into a search engine and have them working behind the scenes, as it were, to allow you to just put in the current spelling and retrieve all the relevant examples from that period.
And then there are new words, as we've been saying. We had this year the selfie that was heard around the world. Obviously, President Obama with the Prime Minister of Denmark and, indeed, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. This... Everybody's made a huge big deal about it, the fact that it is in the Oxford English Dictionary. Should it really be there?
Well, it's not actually Oxford English Dictionary yet. It's in our current dictionary, which is called the Oxford Dictionary, so slightly confusing.
Well, tell us, what does that mean?
Online, we have Oxford Dictionaries online. Well, that's a current dictionary, so it's really for practical, look-up of contemporary words. They tend to have short definitions. OED is about giving you the whole history. We looked at some of those variant spellings, the early spellings. Telling you about the biography of a word, if you like. So you see the whole life story, and a lot of our most common words go back centuries and centuries, right back to Old English.
OMG, for instance. Where did that first turn up?
Well, first turned up, and this will surprise most people, in a letter that an admiral wrote to Winston Churchill in 1917. So it's not quite the youth speak that is decried, is it?
It is amazing to think that. All right. Thank you very much indeed, and congratulations on being OED's new chief editor, the first in 20 years, Michael Prophet. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Michael Prophet, welcome.
Thank you.
Incredibly, you are the first new chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary in 20 years.
That's true.
You've been there, though, way longer, before, you know, all of our businesses started with computers. Mm. Are you surprised that this tome of written words has survived?
Well, I think that my predecessor, John Simpson, and his colleague, Edmund Viner, were very quick to pick up on the potential of the OD in an electronic context. And they converted the OED into digital form in the late 1980s. And by the time we published the second edition then, it was already available on CD-ROM. It was one of the first reference works available on CD-ROM. And then it was also one of the first reference works online in 2000. So it was, we saw an opportunity to publish in a different way, and I think we grabbed it with both hands.
So you have more than kept up with the times.
I hope so, and I think we have to think now about how we can change the dictionary so that it brings it to a new audience who often, I think, expect their content to be in situ, you know, when they need it, where they need it, rather than having to go to a separate reference work.
So what is your mission? How will you do that?
I think it's the challenge is to continue to satisfy the current readership, which is quite broad, and also to bring in a new generation of users who have to perhaps expect it to be more dynamic content that merges with their own needs day to day, I think.
You know, a lot of people will say, hang on a second, you know, and maybe I'm reflecting the sort of traditional generation. Mm. The people like to see this great, big, weighty book that they know they can flip through and find the words and peruse them. Do you sometimes feel you're being forced into this new, brave new world, or is it absolutely vital?
Well, one of the interesting things about the OED is every form in which it's been published until now is still surviving. It's still in print, it's still in CD-ROM form, which surprises a lot of people, and it's online. The advantage of going online is that we can update it much faster. It was quite slow to compile print volumes. They're very complex. They often involve complex typography and different
languages.
How long
do they take, by the way? I heard it takes, I mean, decades.
Yeah,
we think
that we'll finish this current new edition, which is a revision of the whole 20-volume dictionary, within the next 20 years. So it's a long-term project. The original dictionary took 50 years.
50
More,
years?
I mean, it was conceived, actually, from conception to publication, it was about 70.
And how many words for 50 years?
Well, there were about 400,000. We're now up to about 800,000, which is a lot. If you consider that the average person's vocabulary is roughly between 25,000 and 40,000, you can see why they need a dictionary, because even people who are doing 40,000 at the highest end, it's about 5% of what we've got in the OED, and that's not all the words in the language.
Okay, so this started ages and ages ago, and we're going to use our modern Mappy here to bring up some of the words for love, for instance.
Yeah.
Now, love, apparently, if I touch this, will show a huge history of different spellings throughout the ages.
These are all the early spellings. Spelling in English fixed around the 18th century, so it's, in terms of the English language, it's relatively recent. All these spellings date from before then, and most of them didn't survive later than that. But if you want to know the way Shakespeare spelled love, for example, you need to know about these.
Do you know which one it was?
More than one.
More than one.
That's the thing, because there wasn't fixed spelling. And one of the things that this is a good example of what we might do in terms of using, realizing the potential of the OED as data, if you like, rather than just in the dictionary, is if you're using a search engine, it's very literal-minded. So, in theory, you need to know all those spellings to retrieve all the examples in Shakespeare. So put them into a search engine and have them working behind the scenes, as it were, to allow you to just put in the current spelling and retrieve all the relevant examples from that period.
And then there are new words, as we've been saying. We had this year the selfie that was heard around the world. Obviously, President Obama with the Prime Minister of Denmark and, indeed, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. This... everybody's made a huge big deal about it, the fact that it is in the Oxford English Dictionary. Should it really be there?
Well, it's not actually Oxford English Dictionary yet. It's in our current dictionary, which is called the Oxford Dictionary, so slightly confusing.
Well, tell us. What does that mean?
Online, we have Oxford Dictionaries online. Well, that's a current dictionary, so it's really for practical, look-up of contemporary words. They tend to have short definitions. OED is about giving you the whole history. We looked at some of those variant spellings, the early spellings, telling you about the biography of a word, if you like. So you see the whole life story, and a lot of our most common words go back centuries and centuries, right back to Old English.
OMG, for instance. Where did that first turn up?
Well, first turned up, and this will surprise most people, in a letter that an admiral wrote to Winston Churchill in 1917. So it's not quite the youth speak that is decried, is it?
It is amazing to think that. All right. Thank you very much indeed, and congratulations on being OED's new chief editor, the first in 20 years, Mike Prophet. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Escuche la grabación. Complete las frases con una palabra adecuada. El texto se escuchará 3 veces. Ahora dispone usted de 2 minutos para leer las preguntas.
Now, this is not a ranked list, but I think at the end of this discussion, we should see if we can pick out the one thing that, looking back, history will select as the great science breakthrough or landmark of 2013. But let's get started. So, Nicola, you're up first with Richard III.
Yes, I absolutely love this story. It kind of dragged on a bit from 2012 when they first sort of found remains that looked like they might belong to the king, Richard III. And what I absolutely love about this story is that if, at first glance, maybe it sounds just sort of sensational media kind of hyped up story. But on the other hand, I think it's a lovely story which shows how we can learn about our relatively recent past by scientific advances. You know, this used mitochondrial DNA analysis. It used CT scans of the king's skull to try to reconstruct his face.
But
I mean,
can
that's great
back
stuff.
You up 1 second and ask you, how do you recognise a skeleton going, that looks a bit like a king? how did that happen?
Well, the legend went that the body of Richard III was recovered by the friars of Greyfriars and buried. And so the archaeologists thought they'd sort of poke around and see if they could find a body. And I think they actually found it in the first hour of digging, as it happened. And they saw it had a twisted spine, and that gave them a bit of a clue, because, of course, we all know that Richard III reportedly had a bit of a back problem. And it turns out that he did, indeed.
And so what did... The I guess the more forensic analysis tell us about this. So you went to this sort of CSI type analysis of Richard III's remains.
Well, it's interesting. It tells us quite a lot. I mean, it tells us as well that, you know, unlike Shakespeare's depiction of him, he didn't have a humpback, but he had sclerosis. So it's not, you know, it helps to challenge some of the kind of cultural misconceptions that maybe happened. It also showed that, you know, he did die from his war wounds. He hadn't actually, you know, there wasn't anything wrong about the description about how he died. You know, it all confirms things that we've sort of heard in various documentations, but it's nothing like having the hard evidence. And science has done that for us.
And apparently we even know what he ate?
Well, we know that he had a nasty roundworm infection, because they looked at soil samples around the body. And they found that there were sort of eggs from roundworms near his pelvis area, sort of near where the gut, sort of just obviously around that sort of area. But it wasn't found in soil samples around, you know, his skull or anything like that. And these parasites live in the stomach. So it tells us more about him than we would otherwise have known.
All right, we're going to leave Richard III there and on to Robin, who's also all about DNA at the moment.
Yes, and also using DNA as a method for understanding the past, but in this case, a far deeper vision of our history, or even, our prehistory. There was an announcement that they had sequenced the genome of a horse, which was 700,000 years old. Now, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, that was considered rankly impossible to do something as old as that. But on the other hand, there we have, well, just to go back to another discovery, it was made more recently by Svante Paabo at Leipzig, and he is the man who really is doing all the work there. And that is a full sequence of a Neanderthal, genome of a Neanderthal, 65,000 years old. I mean, quite incredible bit of work there that shows all sorts of strange things. For a start, it would seem for the Neanderthals, you know, your mother was your sister and your father is your brother. We're all part of the Paleolithic family, to coin a Manchester United song. In other words, they were intensely inbred. And it also shows this incredible, but it also shows that samples from another set of human beings called the Denisovians is there, and also some other tantalizing fragments of ancient DNA, much older, possibly from Homo erectus, which is, you know, something that, a species that evolved in Africa more than a million years ago. So at that time, there were many different ways to be a human being. In a sense, we're all clones compared to the situation that was existed hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Now, this is not a ranked list, but I think at the end of this discussion, we should see if we can pick out the one thing that, looking back, history will select as the great science breakthrough or landmark of 2013. But let's get started. So, Nicola, you're up first with Richard III.
Yes, I absolutely love this story. It kind of dragged on a bit from 2012 when they first sort of found remains that looked like they might belong to the king, Richard III. And what I absolutely love about this story is that if at first glance, maybe it sounds just sort of sensational media kind of hyped up story. But on the other hand, I think it's a lovely story which shows how we can learn about our relatively recent past by scientific advances. You know, this used mitochondrial DNA analysis. It used CT scans of the king's skull to try to reconstruct his face.
But
I mean,
can
that's
I just back you up 1 second and ask you, how do you recognise a skeleton going, that looks a bit like a king? how did that happen?
Well, the legend went that the body of Richard III was recovered by the friars of Greyfriars and buried. And so the archaeologists thought they'd sort of poke around and see if they could find a body. And I think they actually found it in the first hour of digging as it happened. And they saw it had a twisted spine, and that gave them a bit of a clue, because of course we all know that Richard III reportedly had a bit of a back problem. And it turns out that he did indeed.
And so what did the I guess the more forensic analysis tell us about this? So you went to this sort of CSI type analysis of Richard III's remains.
Oh, it's interesting. It tells us quite a lot. I mean, it tells us as well that, you know, unlike Shakespeare's depiction of him, he didn't have a humpback, but he had sclerosis. So it's not, you know, it helps to challenge some of the kind of cultural misconceptions that maybe happened. It also showed that, you know, he did die from his war wounds. He hadn't actually, you know, there wasn't anything wrong about the description about how he died. You know, it's all confirmed things that we've sort of heard in various documentations, but it's nothing like having the hard evidence. And science has done that for us.
And apparently we even know what he ate?
Well, we know that he had a nasty roundworm infection because they looked at soil samples around the body. And they found that there were sort of eggs from roundworms near his pelvis area, sort of near where the gut, sort of just obviously around that sort of area. But it wasn't found in soil samples around, you know, his skull or anything like that. And these parasites live in the stomach. So it tells us more about him than we would otherwise have known.
All right, we're going to leave Richard III there and on to Robin, who's also all about DNA at the moment.
Yes, and also using DNA as a method for understanding the past, but in this case, a far deeper vision of our history, or even, I should say, our prehistory. First, there was an announcement that they had sequenced the genome of a horse, which was 700,000 years old. Now, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, that was considered rankly impossible to do something as old as that. But on the other hand, there we have, well, just to go back to another discovery, it was made more recently by Svante Paabo at Leipzig, and he is the man who really is doing all the work there. And that is a full sequence of a Neanderthal, genome of a Neanderthal, 65,000 years old. I mean, quite incredible bit of work there that shows all sorts of strange things. For a start, it would seem for the Neanderthals, you know, your mother was your sister and your father is your brother. We're all part of the Paleolithic family, to coin a Manchester United song. In other words, they were intensely inbred. And it also shows this incredible, but it also shows that samples from another set of human beings called the Denisovians is there, and also some other tantalizing fragments of ancient DNA, much older, possibly from Homo erectus, which is, you know, something that, a species that evolved in Africa more than a million years ago. So at that time, there were many different ways to be a human being. In a sense, we're all clones compared to the situation that was existed hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Now, this is not a ranked list, but I think at the end of this discussion, we should see if we can pick out the one thing that, looking back, history will select as the great science breakthrough or landmark of 2013. But let's get started. So, Nicola, you're up first with Richard III.
Yes, I absolutely love this story. It kind of dragged on a bit from 2012 when they first sort of found remains that looked like they might belong to the king, Richard III. And what I absolutely love about this story is that if, at first glance, maybe it sounds just sort of sensational, media, kind of hyped up story. But on the other hand, I think it's a lovely story which shows how we can learn about our relatively recent past by scientific advances. You know, this used mitochondrial DNA analysis. It used CT scans of the king's skull to try to reconstruct his face.
But
I mean,
can
that's great
back
stuff.
You up 1 second and ask you, how do you recognise a skeleton going, that looks a bit like a king? how did that happen?
Well, the legend went that the body of Richard III was recovered by the friars of Greyfriars and buried. And so the archaeologists thought they'd sort of poke around and see if they could find a body. And I think they actually found it in the first hour of digging, as it happened. And they saw it had a twisted spine, and that gave them a bit of a clue, because, of course, we all know that Richard III reportedly had a bit of a back problem. And it turns out that he did, indeed.
And so what did... The I guess the more forensic analysis tell us about this. So you went to this sort of CSI type analysis of Richard III's remains.
Well, it's interesting. It tells us quite a lot. I mean, it tells us as well that, you know, unlike Shakespeare's depiction of him, he didn't have a humpback, but he had sclerosis. So it's not, you know, it helps to challenge some of the kind of cultural misconceptions that maybe happened. It also showed that, you know, he did die from his war wounds. He hadn't actually, you know, there wasn't anything wrong about the description about how he died. You know, it all confirms things that we've sort of heard in various documentations, but it's nothing like having the hard evidence. And science has done that for us.
And apparently we even know what he ate?
Well, we know that he had a nasty roundworm infection, because they looked at soil samples around the body. And they found that there were sort of eggs from roundworms near his pelvis area, sort of near where the gut, sort of just obviously around that sort of area. But it wasn't found in soil samples around, you know, his skull or anything like that. And these parasites live in the stomach. So it tells us more about him than we would otherwise have known.
All right, we're going to leave Richard III there and on to Robin, who's also all about DNA at the moment.
Yes, and also using DNA as a method for understanding the past, but in this case, a far deeper vision of our history, or even, our prehistory. There was an announcement that they had sequenced the genome of a horse, which was 700,000 years old. Now, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, that was considered rankly impossible to do something as old as that. But on the other hand, there we have, well, just to go back to another discovery, it was made more recently by Svante Paabo at Leipzig, and he is the man who really is doing all the work there. And that is a full sequence of a Neanderthal, genome of a Neanderthal, 65,000 years old. I mean, quite incredible bit of work there that shows all sorts of strange things. For a start, it would seem for the Neanderthals, you know, your mother was your sister and your father is your brother. We're all part of the Paleolithic family, to coin a Manchester United song. In other words, they were intensely inbred. And it also shows this incredible, but it also shows that samples from another set of human beings called the Denisovians is there, and also some other tantalizing fragments of the ancient DNA, much older, possibly from Homo erectus, which is, you know, something that, a species that evolved in Africa more than a million years ago. So at that time, there were many different ways to be a human being. In a sense, we're all clones compared to the situation that was existed hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es, El final de la tarea 2.